Hi, boys and girls. Like you, Santa is listening to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Greetings and welcome to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, your host at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, and we are home of the largest ongoing celebration of Christmas online with the world's greatest Christmas community. This episode of the Merry Little Podcast is sponsored by the Christmas Hall of Fame. 2020 marks the first induction year of the Christmas Hall of Fame, and it's filled with nominees who brought forth so much in Christmas from the 19th century. We encourage you to visit ChristmasHallOfFame.net to register and to vote for the first class of inductees, which will be announced on Thanksgiving Day 2020. Make your voice heard as we honor the finest of our Christmas past. Well, for the past several episodes, we have been exploring the Victorian Christmas, an era of time that roughly spans about 60 years from the early 1840s until the turn of the 20th century. It was a time of great change in the world, a time of tremendous growth in technology and transportation, and a time for a great coming together of all things Christmas. In this episode, part 3, we're talking some of the early rock stars of the 19th century Christmas. Some of these might be new to you, or even a surprise. And some, well, you already know very well.
Santa, Santa, Santa Claus, Mommy says you'll soon be here. Santa, Santa, Santa Claus, I've been very good this year.
Away up north in the ice and snow, I'm the jolly old man that you all know. I'm big and round, and I wear a grin, and long white whiskers on my chin.
Santa, Santa, Santa Claus, Mommy says you'll soon be here. Santa, Santa, Santa Claus, I've been very good this year.
If there's one individual who best showcases the change in Christmas during the 19th century, it's Santa Claus. At the beginning of the century, he was barely known at all. To just a few, he was a character known as a little old Dutchman, an individual of mystery, mirth, and merriment who was part of a whispered legend fairly unknown to those who celebrated Christmas. By the end of the 19th century, he was a household name, a character of such strength of image that he was recognizable just about everywhere. Indeed, he had become the face of Christmas, the brand, you could say, so famous that by the time the century mark came around again, he was starring in and the subject of the very first motion picture. He was physically different than when he began the century. He was more opinionated, more likely to reach out and intrude, especially into the ever-changing celebrations of the American Christmas. He was a character of legend whose story grew nearly by the year. His image was starting to be used in books, of course, also in poetry, and on brands of products and into the decorations and operations of retail stores. How exactly did Santa Claus become so famous? Well, without a doubt, his legend in the 19th century at least is safely anchored in the history of Christmas in New York City. It was there that he was first published about by those in literary circles. Two writers, Washington Irving and Clement Clark Moore, were the Christmas creators of the time who launched the Santa Claus legend. Washington Irving was really the father of Santa Claus, having published in 1809, under the pseudonym Diedrich Knickerbocker, a book, the satirical A History of New York from the Beginning of the World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty. In this book, which was very famous and very well received, he makes dozens of references to an impish, pipe-smoking Saint Nicholas who brings gifts down chimneys as he traveled the world bringing gifts to good children. It was from these early tales that Clement Clark Moore crafted his image of the 19th century gift bringer that we all know and love so well today. Like many of the great things of Christmas, Moore's poem was never meant to be shared beyond his home. But also, like so many other great things at Christmas, it was too good not to share. And in 1823, the poem was published in newspapers for the first time, thanks to a family friend. But the thing to understand most was that Moore's poem began a dialogue. His St. Nicholas was so enduring that people simply could not stop talking about him. Christmas after Christmas after Christmas. It was the tradition of newspapers, especially in the early 19th century, to explain the history of the customs and traditions of Christmas. While they could, in great detail, account for the history of the Nativity or the Magi or songs like Deck the Hall or Joy to the World, well, when it came to Santa Claus, well, they kind of struggled. From one newspaper account we read, quote, "Perhaps you would like to know how his name came to be used in connection with Christmas goodies. Many years ago, there was a minister in a foreign land who used to be kind to little children. He never seemed to me more pleased than when he had a troop of them around him, and he usually had his hands laden with many good things for them. So the little children shouted for when the good Santa Claus came among them. After he was dead, the Catholic Church gave him the title of Santa Claudius, and when the merry Christmas times came around, the bright evergreens, the crimson holly buds decked out the hall and the cottage, when the little ones woke in the morning to rejoice over their beautiful gifts, it was common for mothers to say that the good Santa Claudius sent them to them. In the course of the years, the tradition was lost to the many, and the name was corrupted into the now familiar one of Santa Claus," unquote. Said another creative news writer of Santa's history in the 1840s, quote, "Who was Santa Claus? Santa was one of the oldest ideas of the Celtic West in pagan times, as he was of the pagan East before. In Christian times, he was still regarded with religious reverence, sitting, as he had sat for ages in Egypt and elsewhere, in the arms of his mother. Santa Claus was, in fact, the child Jesus in the Middle Ages. And through that period, the festive creed of Germany and all Celtic Europe was that he visited all family dwellings of good Christians on the eve of his anniversary and brought with him gifts and blessings for the children. This beautiful tradition is still to be found lingering in Germany, though Santa Claus does not seem to be specially connected with it by name. The truth of this original belief is plainly enough indicated by the word Claus, which in the Gothic or ancient German means child and son. Santa Claus formerly meant the Holy Child," unquote. Now that bit of creative history is from the New York Times, if you can believe it or not. Regardless of all the creative histories and suspect narratives about Santa Claus, one thing is absolutely evident from 19th century media about him. He captured the imagination of both children and adults who simply could not stop talking about him or having a great deal of fun because of him. Christmas customs were clearly transitioning in the early 19th century, especially in New York. There is mention of Santa Claus as a figure of celebration at both Christmas and New Year. The giving of gifts was always associated with him, but so too were some other traditions. In his appearance at New Year's, which seemed to be more, well, let's say adult-centered, well, he was great fun. One where not only were gifts merrily exchanged, but that kissing, most certainly, was to be a big part between men and women. In the New York Evening Post, way back in 1815, they published this mirthful declaration ahead of the holidays of that year, which addressed, perhaps, the reluctance of the kissing tradition among some women. Quote, see if you can keep up with this. "We, Sanctus Nicholas, Arch Emperor of the Fashions, Lord Protector of handsome girls, women, married or unmarried, not accepting ugly girls, and old maids of all sorts and sizes, sovereign governor of old men married or unmarried, bachelors, young men married or unmarried, and all description of males do send this imperial mandate greeting. Whereas our consort, the Empress Santa Claus, has most rebelliously, feloniously, treasonably, and outrageously, and disloyally endeavored by a seditious proclamation to dissuade our most dutiful and loyal subjects from their obedience to the most high and sacred authority. Whereas the sovereign sway of our ever illustrious and ever memorable ancestors has, through all ages, been acknowledged supreme. And whereas it has become notorious that some of our hitherto most loyal subjects have been induced by said seditious proclamation to swerve from their duty, insomuch that they have expressed the approbation of the innovations therein proposed. And whereas these said innovations, if adopted, will have the pernicious tendency of creating civil war among our subjects, of confounding all social order, and bringing to the verge of destruction customs venerated by our ancestors from time immemorial. And furthermore, whereas no proclamation in these our wide extended dominions can be of any avail unless sanctioned by our imperial permission, and whereas the said Empress Santa Claus has issued the said treasonable proclamation without our knowledge or sanction, now therefore we, Sanctus Nicholas, Arch-Emperor of Fashions, do hereby order, decree, and declare the said proclamation to be null, void, and of no effect, and moreover do offer and proffer a reward of 1,000 kisses to be taken in such portions as, at a time that best suits her, to any young lady who will give us information of any person that may be convicted of violating this our sovereign decree." Unquote. Santa Claus was complicated in the early 19th century. But you see, when Moore's poem hit the newspapers just a few years later, the shift of St. Nicholas was to become a focus of children. And it was cemented. Christmas, absent of anything in the church, became an interactive sport in the home. The Christmas tree had to be procured, decorated with ornaments and candles, and Santa Claus had to be prepared for by finding the largest stocking possible and hung by the chimney with care. We would refer you to our podcast episode titled Legend of the Christmas Stocking for more about this time-honored practice. But from the early 1820s onward, the tradition of Santa Claus and stockings was a tradition that was eagerly attended to. For shopkeepers and merchandisers, Christmas instantly took on greater value. As early as the 1830s, we see Santa adopted by retailers of all types. From a December 12th advertisement in the 1840s from Norwalk, Ohio, we read this in an ad, quote, "The following telegraphic communication has been received from the old man to J.P. Williams of Williams Variety Store. You are hereby authorized to announce to the people of Erie and Huron counties that I shall be present at your variety store on Christmas and New Year's Eves, ready to deliver to persons such as toys, fancy goods, etc., as your numerous customers may desire. To prevent the possibility of failure on my part, I have had my reindeers reshod and my sled overhauled. Yours, in a whirl, Santa Claus." Unquote. The presence of Santa Claus on site in a store for folks to meet is something of a debate. They debated about it then and they argue about it now, just who was the first store to actually land him. In perusing several newspapers of the time, I frankly can't decide other than to tell you that I found Santa in a store as early as 1831, of course, in New York City. There are lots of places that will argue with me on that, claiming they are the first, and I don't suppose that it really matters. What was Santa bringing? Well, that's a huge topic, and we'll get to that in a bit.
Jolly old St. Nicholas, lean your ear this way. Don't you tell a single soul what I'm gonna say. Christmas time is coming soon, now you dear old man. Whisper what you've got for me, tell me if you can. Jingle, jingle, tinkle, tinkle, sleigh bells in the snow. It's jolly old St. Nicholas and his reindeer, don't you know? Jingle, 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 tinkle, 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 sleigh bells in the snow. It's jolly old St. Nicholas and his reindeer, don't you know?
There was, throughout the 1840s and 1850s, a huge market for anything Santa Claus related. I'm not talking about the stuff that Santa would bring or stuff into a stocking. I'm talking about the things that bore Santa's image or told more about his story. Think about it. Moore's poem could be handwritten on a single sheet of paper. But from an 1851 advertisement from Monongahela, Pennsylvania, a grand Christmas pictorial was offered for sale. Art. And it showed Santa at his home, Santa in his workshop, Santa on his Christmas journey in a sleigh drawn by 12 reindeers, Santa visiting the fireside of a family of good children, Santa making a call at a home of naughty children and giving each a rod, a picture of the joy of Christmas morning, a family fireside on Christmas Eve, and all of this could be had for 15 cents if purchased in person, or 20 cents if sent in the mail. Can you imagine the treasure it would be to see such a publication from 1851? Santa Claus also was not immune to the troubles of his time. In 1857, the year that Jingle Bells was published, printed in several newspapers, we note this alarming bit of news. Quote, "The Schenectady Star mentions a sad and really painful rumor which is working its way into our poorer circles and which, for the sake of young Americans, it is earnestly hoped is false." Says the Star, "It is said that Santa Claus, the jolly old fellow who even we used to love so well, fallen, failed. His carriage, his tiny reindeer that we heard once every year all through the short apron period, even his short pipe, have been taken over by his unfeeling creditors, and of his trinkets there is scarcely any left. Poor Santa. We wonder if adversity has robbed his cheek of the flush of health, or destroying the rotundity of his little round belly. We wonder how he will climb upon the roof Christmas Eve night, and how he will carry the dolls for the girls, and the whistles and the whatnots for the boys without breaking them. He cannot go the usual rounds with his usual speed, that is certain, and we hope those who are disappointed will not think of themselves but pity poor Santa Claus and blame hard times only. There will be many stockings hung up in vain this year, and sorrow will drop from the eyes that have been bright with gladness on many a Christmas morning. May Santa Claus do his best to serve all who are looking for him, and we believe he will." Unquote. I don't know what was going on in 1857, but times must have been pretty hard. In our modern-day celebration of Christmas, Santa continues to play a prominent part. We love to celebrate him not only in practice, but also in culture. We have music, we have movies, and we have contact with Santa Claus in so many new and modern ways. But still, for all he is, we find Christmas without him in other ways that is just as entertaining and endearing. And they did the same during the Victorian era of Christmas.
Thank you.
This rendition of Jingle Bells is brilliantly called Jingle Bells Sad Christmas and is provided for us graciously via YouTube by Tom Musinex. You can find links to his channel as well as his Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts on the show notes page for this episode at merrypodcast.com. We're grateful for the mood that it sets for this segment, especially since we're about to drop some really big names from the history of Christmas. In the classic Christmas movie, It's a Wonderful Life, there are three scenes that continually grab the attention of fans for one very unusual element. George Bailey receives three times bad news in that movie. When his father dies and George has to take over the building alone. When the bank crashes and he has to use the money set aside for his honeymoon. And when Uncle Billy loses the $8,000, putting everything in jeopardy and pushing poor George to the brink of suicide. In all three of those scenes, a prolific character actor plays a part who actually has nothing to do with the story. He is Jimmy the Raven, a real bird who appeared in hundreds of Hollywood films over a period of more than 20 years. He was a favorite of filmmaker Frank Capra, and he became something of a fixture in almost all of his films. Why, and what does this have to do with the Victorian Christmas? Well, Capra was born at the very end of these years in 1895, so it stands to reason that he was influenced by the time period. Among his heroes was Edgar Allan Poe, a famous American poet whose most famous work was a poem titled The Raven. The 1845 poem famously begins, "Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as if someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Well, if you ever had to study Edgar Allan Poe in school, you know that he was beloved for his dark works of horror and mystery. He became one of the best writers of his time and one of the first real rock stars in American pop culture. Who was the inspiration for Poe's famous Raven? Well, it was none other than Charles Dickens, who Poe met in 1842. Dickens came to America on kind of a tour with his wife and many of his children and with his pet raven that he called Grip. During this trip, Dickens and Poe met briefly for a while. Poe, you see, was a fan of a recent novel Dickens had written called Barnaby Rudge. In this historical novel, there was a character, a bird named Grip, that captured Poe's imagination. It was only during this chance meeting between the two writers that Poe learned that the bird of the book was based on Dickens' real-life pet, also named Grip. Perhaps most interesting to note in this meeting is that it happened before Dickens wrote his famous work, A Christmas Carol, and before Poe wrote his most famous work, The Raven. By the way, where else but on the Merry Little Podcast can you go from It's a Wonderful Life and Frank Capra to Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Dickens in under a minute? This is the kind of Christmas coincidence that we just love. Anyway, this chance encounter between Dickens and Poe illustrates just how small the world of famous writers were in the 19th century, but more importantly, just how many writers enjoyed so much influence over the expanding popularity of Christmas. In fact, just as Dickens and Poe were acquainted, so too were Poe and a much bigger literary star in Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, a writer who would influence both Christmas and Thanksgiving during these pre-Civil War years. Now, earlier this year, in the Merry Little Podcast episode titled Christmas in Crisis, we talked about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and his poem titled Christmas Bells. That experience, built around the tragedies that Longfellow suffered during the Civil War period, go far in explaining the heartbreak of Christmas during those years. But Longfellow should not be dismissed with just that great work of Christmas under his belt. He was truly a major star of the 19th century for his contributions to American literature and the celebration of American holidays. Long before Christmas bells, Longfellow was, like Dickens, a hero of literature. He was known as the children's poet because his works were often used, both during his lifetime and beyond, in schoolrooms to teach history. I'm not sure if it's still true, but I remember learning the works of Longfellow when I was a kid in school. Longfellow was so famous and so beloved during his lifetime that Edgar Allan Poe suffered from no small amount of professional jealousy because of him. Because Poe was so dark, he was not as well understood, certainly not popular with children. And it cost him, literally, in terms of his fortune. Some historians muse that Longfellow and his success may have actually helped to lead Poe's sad and sudden passing, his descent into madness, they say. Longfellow's works were broadly known and accepted. They were used because Longfellow knew how to tell a story, much like Dickens, and he often used the backdrop of history in doing so. Who hasn't heard of The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere or The Song of Hiawatha? Longfellow was a master of telling stories in historical context that were intensely personal. One story in particular is very personal for Longfellow, and it is in his famous work, The Courtship of Miles Standish. Longfellow is a direct descendant, you see, of John and Priscilla Alden, both passengers on the Mayflower. Historians to this day debate whether the story of Longfellow, told by Longfellow of his great-grandparents, is fact or fiction. Longfellow said it was a story handed down through his family history, but historians can't entirely account for it. Another descendant of the John Alden family, Timothy Alden, first told the story of the Pilgrim Love Triangle in his book, American Epitaphs, in 1814. The story would become famous with Longfellow's epic poem of the tale, a story he loved and struggled with for more than 2 years to write. After it was published, Longfellow famously said of the story in 1858, quote, "It is always disagreeable when the glow of composition is over to criticize what one has been in love with," unquote. In the poem, Plymouth's military leader, Miles Standish, asked John Alden to court Priscilla Mullins on his behalf. This causes John to be torn between faithfulness to his captain and the longings of his own heart. Of course, as the tale is skillfully woven, John and Priscilla fall in love, and the dilemma reaches a climax as Priscilla famously mused, "Why don't you just speak for yourself, John?" Longfellow's attempt to balance a romanticized view of Puritan values and culture with an epic exaggeration of Standish's heroism and exploits captured the imagination of American readers in the 19th century, and it made household names of John and Priscilla. It is interesting to note the cultural impact that this story would have on American history overall. You see, Longfellow's poem came just a few years after the discovery of William Bradford's written history of Plymouth Colony in 1854. The poem was released just in advance of the Civil War, a time when the holidays of Christmas and Thanksgiving were exploding in American culture. Bradford's history, coupled with Longfellow's courtship of Miles Standish, advanced the recognition of Thanksgiving as a national holiday, although it had clearly been celebrated in New England and beyond since the mid-1600s. So popular was the poem in the 1860s after Lincoln's recognition of a national day of Thanksgiving, it became a fad of sorts to lay claim to Pilgrim ancestry, a fad repeated in this year of 2020 as we celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower. Northerners in particular were thrilled to celebrate national history that was not centered in Virginia. And as the nation recovered from the war, their Victorian sensibilities were enamored with the Puritan ideals of moral rectitude, fair-mindedness, and hard work. To claim an ancestor on the Mayflower somehow made one more American. To celebrate Thanksgiving also made one more American. This is an important thing to note when considering all the elements of what makes the Victorian Christmas special. Thanksgiving, you see, is a huge part of it. Thank you. Now, we've talked of Thanksgiving at length here on the Merry Little Podcast many times. We encourage you to go back through those episodes to learn more about the Victorian Christmas. The song that you're hearing at the top of this segment is titled Over the River and Through the Wood, and it's based on a children's book that was published in 1844. Can you see how all these elements combine from around the same time? Over the River and Through the Wood in 1844, Dickens and A Christmas Carol in 1843, Poe's poem titled The Bells in 1848, followed by Longfellow's work of The Courtship of Miles Standish in the 1850s. America was constantly exposed to more and more popular history fare and holiday fare through the only kind of media that could reach everyone, the written word. It is important to realize that holidays didn't just burst on the scene at this time. As we pointed out, it was constantly building, especially in America. By 1844, America's media was already in a habit of talking Christmas and Thanksgiving with amazing regularity. It was, in that year, a throwback, a sentimental memory of how Thanksgiving was celebrated for more than 200 years already in America. That's what Over the River and Through the Wood was all about, remembering Thanksgiving. It was written by an extraordinary woman named Lydia Maria Child, decades before Christmas and Thanksgiving became recognized as official holidays. It was through her efforts and others that we know that Christmas and Thanksgiving were long traditions in North America. Lydia Maria Child was a woman very far ahead of her time. Born in 1802, she made her voice heard through the power of her pen. She was an accomplished writer, editor, and civil rights activist, and in the early 19th century, that was something rare to hear from a woman. During her day, she would be controversial and even daring in the eyes of some. In the 19th century man's world, she was a force that tackled the prickly topics of slavery, male dominance, and white supremacy. There was, like her, another woman of great accomplishment that we owe a debt of gratitude to for the recognition of Thanksgiving as a national holiday. Her name is Sarah Josepha Hale, a writer, editor, and activist who persisted for years in urging American presidents to declare Thanksgiving a holiday. Hale was a groundbreaking role model for women who pushed for women's rights during a darker time in American history for women. She was also a flaming American patriot who loved the Union and who cherished her colonial heritage. She wrote tirelessly to Presidents Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, Buchanan, and Lincoln of her belief that Thanksgiving needed to be a national holiday. Finally, in 1863, President Lincoln agreed, saying in part, "It has seemed me fit and proper that we should be solemnly, reverently, and gratefully acknowledge as with one heart and voice by the whole American people. I do therefore invite my fellow citizens in every part of the United States, and also those who are at sea, and those who are sojourning in foreign lands, to set and observe the last Thursday of November next as a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens," unquote.
Go tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere. Go tell it on the mountain that Jesus Christ is born. Go tell it on the mountain.
The American Civil War was a turning point not only in American history, but also in Christmas history. That story has to include an accounting of Christmas for the American slaves. Christmas for the American slave was a time of hope and irony. Slaveholders and white landowners, as many Americans do today, deviated from their routines during the holidays for the celebration of Thanksgiving, Christmas, and the New Year. It was a time of festivity and gift-giving. Slaves looked forward to Christmas because it meant a season of unusual generosity by their owners as they received new yearly allotments of clothing, perhaps something new or even a special food or maybe even a gift of something more than was, well, necessary just for survival on the plantation. Among their many traditions was the ironic game of Christmas gift. Slaves and children would lie in wait for those with the means to provide presents and capture them, crying, Christmas gift, and refusing to release their prisoners until they received some sort of token gift in return. This ironic inversion of power occasionally led to real transformation in the life of a slave. A slave by the name of Henry, a man whose tragic life and death is recounted in Martha Griffith Brown's Autobiography of a Female Slave, saved Christmas gifts and money to buy his freedom. For many, during this time frame of American history, and even among African Americans in bondage, Christmas was a time of religious observance laced with sentiments of hope and peace. Such feelings ran contrary to the strife of the times during the Civil War, as the lessons of Christmas we still struggle with today were very much in evidence even then. But slaves lacked many of the elements of the season we so often associate with Christmas, even back in the 1850s and 60s. They didn't have Christmas trees, they didn't have ornaments, and they didn't even really have Santa Claus. Their Christmas traditions centered around religion and music. Longfellow was not only a famous writer and poet, he was also a well-known professor of literature and language at Harvard for many years. It was there that he taught a young man destined to become a minister by the name of Philip Brooks. Brooks was a very tall man, nearly 6'8" in height. But this giant of a man was soft-spoken, and he had a tender place in his heart for children. In December of 1865, Philip Brooks traveled to the Holy Land. His itinerary included a horseback ride from Jerusalem to Bethlehem on Christmas Eve. Back then, Bethlehem truly was a small village, far removed from the bustling city it would later become. By nightfall, he was in the field where, according to tradition and legend, the shepherds heard the angelic announcement. Something about the beauty and simplicity of that visit stayed with Philip Brooks when he returned to America. Several years later, when he wanted a new Christmas song for the children to sing at his church, he reached back in his memory for inspiration from his visit to the Holy Land. The poem he wrote painted in words the sights and sounds of that little town of Bethlehem that he had visited. Writing to the children of his congregation, he recalled that visit. Quote, "I remember especially Christmas Eve when I was standing in the old church in Bethlehem, close to the spot where Jesus was said to be born, when the whole church was ringing hour after hour with the splendid hymns of praise to God, how again and again it seemed as if I could hear voices I knew well, telling each other of the wonderful night of the Savior's birth." Unquote. Through three episodes now of the Merry Little Podcast, we've only taken it up so far to the period of the Great Civil War. When folks think of the Victorian Christmas, they tend to focus on the stuff of, well, old Victorian-style homes with the wraparound porches, the heavily decorated trees featuring laced ornaments and shining tapers, and of course, the falling of snow and the jingling of bells. We're getting to all of that. Christmas went supernova after the Civil War in so many different areas, in music, in entertainment, in decorating, in technology, and in travel. Everything in Christmas accelerated after the Civil War, and we will go far to explain how and why. Coming up in part four of the Victorian Christmas are two names that, despite all we've spoken about so far, shine far and above the others when it comes to the influence over Christmas in America during the Victorian era. First was the American illustrator Thomas Nast, and a name not mentioned near often enough in the annals of Christmas history, President Abraham Lincoln. Join us at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, where we celebrate the Victorian Christmas and all other periods of Christmas history year-round, every day of the year. For MyMerryChristmas.com, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.